Okay, so let me remind where we stopped, where we paused after the previous hour. Very good. So we paused at setting up an experiment where we lower a qubit, so putting it carefully in a box, attaching it to a string, and lowering it carefully into a black hole, into a Schwarzschild black hole, for simplicity. So this qubit has entropy, or we put it in a state with entropy log 2. So it can be either spin up or spin down. So it's in a mixed state. And the question is whether, in this process, the entropy of the black hole changes. Because we also came up with the proposal that the entropy of the black hole should be proportional to its area. So it's some coefficient, which we don't know yet, times the area of its horizon, which for a Schwarzschild black hole is just proportional to m squared. Okay, so this qubit has a mass. Okay, that's always, every particle has a mass. So let's call it mu. So mu squared will be, it's square of its four momentum. Let me see how this works. Is it lowered or raised?
There is the
in here. I see.
Yeah.
So in principle, very good. Perfect. Okay, so what we said, we have this mass. Now, the question is, when I consider the system and perform this experiment, I definitely get some work from this process, right? Because this particle is attracted to black hole. So when I kind of pull the string here with some force, and if I let it go, I perform some negative work on the string, or say if you want, this particle perform some work on me. So the energy of this particle decreases. So if it were mass, far away in the asymptotic region, when it approaches the black hole, it's no longer mass. So let's evaluate what this energy is. So in this formula, the energy is actually P naught in this formula. So that's the energy. And if I continue writing it down, this expression in the Schwarzschild, in the case of Schwarzschild black hole, I will get. Okay, let me write maybe intermediate steps as well. So, as I said, I lower it adiabatically so that momentum in the direction of r in the radial direction is actually zero. I can set it to zero. So then I will get that the energy is E squared, and here I have to put the metric, which will be 1/2m/r. Yeah, there is a question, Serge?
Oh, no, I answered myself.
Okay, very good. So from here I get that the energy when this particle is at the distance r, the radius r, is mass times square root of 2m/r. So we see that the energy decreases when we're I bring this particle closer and closer to the horizon, and that makes sense because this is nothing but redshift. So basically, it's gravitational redshift. Yeah, if I take something which has energy mu and bring it and keep it, in a gravitational field, then the energy is redshifted by the corresponding, factor, the corresponding coefficient in the metric. Very good. So then we bring this particle and then we drop it, as we discussed. And the change in the black hole mass, delta m, will be actually this energy, right? Because the energy is conserved in the process. So here it looks like that we can, if we bring this particle arbitrarily close to the horizon, then the change in the black hole mass will be arbitrarily small. And that's Yeah, if the change in the mass will be arbitrarily small, then there will be no change in the black hole entropy. So that looks like a contradiction to what we discussed previously. So okay. What's wrong? Any ideas? Yeah, the wrong part is that the size of the, well, actually this distance to which I can bring the particle cannot be arbitrarily small due to uncertainty principle. So we know that there is uncertainty principle that tells that a particle can be localized only at distances bigger than 1 over uncertainty in its momentum. The uncertainty in the momentum, which for relativistic particles, well, here we are discussing kind of extreme regimes, so the, we want to make like precision in the distance as like this uncertainty as small as possible. We want to make the uncertainty in the momentum as large as possible. So the particle, we can actually use the relativistic estimate, you know, in this regime if we want to put to the extreme, or push to the extreme. So we can say that this uncertainty in the momentum is of order uncertainty in the energy. But this is bounded by the mass of the particle itself, because if I have a situation where uncertainty in the energy is larger than the mass, then actually particle production starts. So this particle will be, if I kind of try to squeeze my system too much, I will start pair-producing these particles, and that's essentially quantum and relativistic effect. So to be able to really kind of control how many particles I have to impose that this uncertainty is smaller than the mass. So a single particle, single quantum particle, can be localized only at the distances bigger than inverse mass. But that's actually nothing but the Compton wavelength of the particle. So that's more or less like known, perhaps you already encountered this statement, that in some sense, like particles, I could say particles have finite size. Actually, that's not a good phrasing. Yeah, I think a good phrasing is really like the uncertainty in the particle positions is bigger than the Compton wavelengths. So you cannot localize particles better. Okay, so we have this inequality. And we have to take into account in here. So that will imply that delta r is bigger than something. We still have to understand what, because delta r and delta is not the same as delta l. So that's physical distance here. Delta r is just coordinate distance. So we have to relate the two. That's a small exercise in general relativity, or even kind of geometry. So we know that the physical distance, the physical interval, is related to the coordinate interval by this formula, right? That just comes from the metric, Schwarzschild metric. And so we can integrate, we can say, okay, that then the physical distance, say, from the horizon is integral dr 1 over square root 2m over r from horizon rh to the point where I want to go, actually. Let's say RH plus delta R. And this is approximately, okay, if I do this integral and I assume that I'm staying very close to the horizon, then from here I will get that this is some factors. And here I get square root of, or geometric mean of horizon radius and delta R. So this is the thing that should be bigger than Compton wavelength. And now, kind of putting things together, so we see that the energy, I'm taking it from here, so the energy is, it's of order. Okay, let me put twiddles. Mu, then I have square root of delta r over r, but r is approximately horizon radius, so I can put 2m here. So then I take this constraint from here. This is bigger than mu 1 over root of 2m. That's from here, and from there I have 1 over 1 over mu squared times 8 times m, square root of everything. Right. So altogether I get 1 over 4m. So notice that the particle mass have cancelled. So nothing, well, kind of the final answer, well, the final minimal energy that the particle can have before dropping does not depend on the mass of the particle itself, depends only on the mass of the black hole, or rather on its radius, if you want. So here we are. So remember, well, basically let me summarize what we found, that the change in the black hole mass is bigger or equal 1 over 4m. Yeah? So it's finite. Yeah, I think the main finding is that it's finite. It cannot be zero. And then we can kind of go back and work out what it implies for the change of the horizon area. So horizon area, I will call it with letter A sometime if I use it. So that's just okay. Square pi m square. So it's 16 pi times 2 m times delta m. And taken from here, we find that this is bigger than 8 pi. Okay. Yeah. So. So bigger than zero, and actually is bounded by a finite, well, how to say, is bounded by a number, yeah, in Planck units. You remember what we're working in Planck units, so that's 8 pi in Planck units, in Planck areas, yeah, so that's a minimal increase. And with this consideration, then our identification makes sense. We can even estimate that this alpha, we can even, you know, say now, that this, we know what this alpha should be if we really believe that we're kind of like dropping one qubit should correspond to this change in the area. So then perhaps we should write something like log 2 over 8 pi a. Well, that's still an estimate. In fact, this coefficient, well, is not this log 2 over 8 pi, but in fact it's 1/4. I mean, the exact value of it is 1/4, which we will derive later using, well, which actually was fixed by Hawking. Once Hawking discovered Hawking temperature, Hawking radiation, and Hawking temperature, then it automatically fixes this this coefficient through the first law of thermodynamics. Because first law of thermodynamics tells us that the change in the entropy should be equal to temperature times change in the energy, which is change in the mass. Yeah, and if we know the temperature, we will know this formula precisely. this entropy derivation appeared actually before Hawking derivation of the radiation, of the Hawking radiation. And already this formula implies, in fact, that black holes should have temperature. So in this sense, yeah, it was not, I mean, this for a while, for actually pretty short while, this was just interpreted as a bit of curiosity, like this this black hole entropy, because people didn't know that there's any temperature associated to that. But actually, yeah, pretty soon it was fixed, and yeah, with discovery of Hawking radiation that we will discuss later in the lectures, everything falls into places. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
The general idea is that we cannot transfer an arbitrary small amount of energy to the black hole, right?
Yeah. So So having this definition of black hole, well, entropy that like naturally leads to like more like generalized formulation of second law of thermodynamics. Well, actually, I think now we can just say this is the second law of thermodynamics in systems involving black holes, that like the total entropy of the system is well, entropy of black hole, one or many black holes if we have, plus the entropy of everything which is outside, of normal matter outside of that. So basically that should be, like this is the correct formula for the entropy of the whole system, and the second law of thermodynamics will tell that this generalized entropy never decreases. And here there are two exercises for you. Because we kind of, that's still a proposal or a conjecture, which must pass various tests, and it has passed various tests. So I suggest you to make a few of them. Okay, first one is the following. So consider, you know, the same black hole and the same qubit, which I now don't kind of bring, you know, to the black hole, but just let fall into it. Yeah, I let it fall. And I let it fall along geodesics, not necessarily radial. Okay, so in principle, like I just, you know, like there is black hole, there is this thing. I kind of may probably give it a small kick, yeah, and let it fall. So basically argue that this process cannot violate the second law of thermodynamics. Yeah, no matter how I arrange this process, I mean this generalized second law will still hold.
So the exercise would be to show that explicitly. What you just said about the second law.
To prove that this total entropy never decreases.
Okay.
No matter how I let this particle move. Well, move freely. Yeah, upon launch here. Yeah, another check we can do. Okay, so let me give it to you as an exercise as well. Yeah, so let's say another exercise is the following. So we again take the black hole, but now lower not a single qubit, but a box filled with radiation with some temperature. Yeah, so here we have radiation. Radiation with temperature T. So we take this box, we attach it to the string, we carefully put it towards the horizon, and then open it and let radiation flow inside. Question?
Yes. What if I didn't have a qubit? What if I had just a particle that would one state? Does it mean that I would, like, so that this means that it would be able to calculate its entropy by using the same process?
No, the entropy can increase. So if you say the particle didn't have entropy, but then black hole got some entropy, it's fine. I mean, it increased. Well, in fact, on the other hand, you can even argue, or at least try to argue, that even a single particle has an entropy in the sense that, yeah, if we interpret entropy a bit differently. So here I was sticking to this thermodynamic entropy, but you can also think about information, like entropy as a lack of information. And if you lose a particle, you may say you lost some notion, you know, some knowledge, whether this particle existed or not. So you can also think of it as a bit. And actually, that's how Bekenstein puts it in his derivation. So he even kind of assigns, just entropy, like loss of entropy. No, actually, increase of entropy to the loss of particle. And that would still work because, yeah, so far, I mean, all these derivations, they are so far estimates. Yeah, so they are kind of at the level of order of magnitude. So we cannot pin down the precise coefficients anyway. Because, yeah, when I say that, say the characteristic uncertainty is of order Compton wavelengths, okay, it can be two Compton wavelengths or pi, maybe, yeah, so. Does that make sense? Okay, coming back to this exercise. Okay, so what I was saying that we have this gas here that we let flow into black hole and disappear from us, and then we take back this box, fill it again, bring it back, open it, and get some work because of this, right? Because as I said, I mean, when we lower, we can make a machine, yeah, that will work. It's an engine that works on black holes, right? The question, does this engine violate second law of thermodynamics? Okay, for you to show that it does not. Or okay, yeah, prove that it does not violate the second law of thermodynamics. In fact, as a comment, so you asked me about what we have a particle which is you know which doesn't have any spin, right? But actually, you could ask also what we have a particle which has a very high spin. Yeah, what if we have a particle that has spin sigma, which is much bigger than one, and then log sigma, I mean its entropy can be very large. In fact, I think, I mean, if we insist that second law is not violated, and we believe it's not, yeah, from init right, that actually implies that particles with high spin cannot be elementary. So which is true. We don't have an element, like in nature, any elementary particles with high spins. So these particles can be only composite, and then their size is bigger than their Compton wavelengths. So basically, this gives us a way to bound from below the sizes of high spin particles. I don't think the bound will be very, very strict, but still. Okay. Okay, then one more exercise. That one is a bit more challenging. So let me put a star here. Consider a spherical black hole with electric charge. Right, so now it's a black hole with mass, but also charge. This one is described by the Reissner-Nordström metric. So the metric is different from Schwarzschild. So it has, it's actually kind of has similar form, but details are different. So in the case of Schwarzschild, this is just 1 over, in the case of Schwarzschild, that was 1 over 2m over r, 1 minus 2m over r, whereas in the case of Reiss and Nordström, there is an additional term q square over r square. And also, besides metric, there is an electric potential, which can be chosen to be static and have this form, which actually is the same as for a point Coulomb charge, a point electric charge. Yeah, AI, like space components are zero. So this is just Coulomb potential. Yeah, it has normal form. Despite the curvature of the metric and everything, yeah, this is pretty simple. So the questions. Should I write it? Write it here. So question number one, or number A. Find the area of the horizon. Yeah. Horizon area. When I say find, means express it in terms of mass and charge. And Question B is to consider this Bekenstein process that we discussed. So basically taking a particle and lowering it slowly into black hole and releasing it. Now we can kind of consider charged particles. So this particle, or okay, this particle will have mass and charge. So the task is to estimate the minimal increase of the horizon area and see if it contradicts the second law of thermodynamics or not. So minimal okay, questions? Then let's start new topic. So new topic is general formalism for fields in curved spacetime. So far, we were doing estimates, which is always good to be able to do before you go to explicit, like to detailed calculations. But now let's discuss how the detailed calculations would be done, right? Or will be done. In this course, we'll be always dealing, like we'll be doing calculations with a simple field one can imagine, which is scalar field. So the scalar field has an action, by the way, now, from now on, S is action, not entropy. Action. Yeah, the letter S is used for many things in physics. In d-dimensional spacetime, here's a Lagrangian. So that's non-interacting field, yeah, and we're not gonna include interactions. Well, it interacts only with gravity, right? So, or you can think, say it just propagates and it feels non-trivial metric, well, as everything should. So we'll be working, here I put d dimensions. Well, usually it will be 4 or 2, because many things become simpler in 2 dimensions, so we'll be often referring to that case. But in principle, also, almost everything can be repeated in arbitrary number of dimensions. Then what else we have here? So we have mass, and in general, we can also have a non-trivial coupling, like additional coupling to the curvature, like this, where psi is some parameter. There is particularly, why I'm including that? Because there is special value of this psi, which depends on the dimension dependent, where this system acquires more symmetry than otherwise. Namely, this whole action becomes invariant under rescalings of the metric, or so-called violent transformation of the metric, accompanied by some proper rescaling of the field. So in general, that doesn't happen. Yeah, in general. When I say that the symmetry appears only in the case if the mass is zero, in the massless case. So also the mass term in general, I mean, always violates the symmetry. But yeah, if the mass is zero and the coupling has this value, then we have this additional wild symmetry in the action. And that's all, yeah, you will see that it's quite handy in particular, like specific applications. Okay, so from this action, we easily get equations of, equation of motion just by the usual variational principle. So it will tell us that the box minus m squared plus xi r acting on phi is zero, where this box is g mu nu times covering derivatives.
So you wrote like ordinary derivatives there and covariant derivatives in the...
Yeah, here you can use either because it's scalar field. So you can use either... I mean, covariant derivative acting on scalar is the same as ordinary.
Oh, okay, that's why. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so how do we go through quantization? Let's discuss quantization in flat space. And four dimensions. Yeah, let's specify to four dimensions for simplicity. Okay, so we have here we have a well-defined algorithm. So step number one is to take this take the solutions of these equations of this equation and expand it in plane waves. Yeah. So we're saying that we represent well, actually, any like general solution of this equation is just an expansion in plane waves. So sum over all possible momenta that the particles can have. Here I have plane wave modes multiplied by some like free amplitudes. Okay, so let me describe notations. So I put sum here. As I think is a more general notation for the integral. So in actual flat space, it will be of course an integral over momenta, but yeah, in some more specific circumstances with say finite volume or something, you can have sums here instead. So okay, I will be using sums most often, just you know for this type of integrals, for this type of expansions. So then these modes U, they are just plane waves, okay, properly normalized. And U star is just a complex conjugate. So let me say here I have the same factor. And here I have plus I omega t minus I k x, where omega is defined with plus sign. So it's a square root of k square plus m square. So it solves the you know, like the dispersion, well, it's dispersion relation basically, which follows from this equation. Yeah, it has two roots, plus minus. Okay, so we define omega with plus sign and define our modes like u that multiplies, that kind of enters in the first term with this positive omega in here. So also these modes are called positive frequency. And these modes, you see, they have opposite sign in here in the frequency part, so they are negative frequency. Now, of course, that's very confusing because positive frequency means negative, means minus sign here. Negative frequency means plus. But yeah, get used to it.
I still think it's better than the other metric with like plus, minus, 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 where you have like the space is negative.
Yeah, but that's not about the metric actually. Because, I'm kind of not using metric here even.
Oh, yes.
So it's really about, you know, if time, I mean, it's about where is the forward time direction, okay? Forward time direction where t increases, okay? And then, yeah, if we have we define frequency with respect to this, you know, to this direction, and the positive frequency modes should have minus sign. That's just kind of historically, that's how it was. Or like positive energy corresponds to this type of evolution. Okay, so that was step A. Now step B is to perform quantization. So impose canonical commutation relations. Well, there are different ways to quantize the system, but yeah, one kind of most robust one is to do canonical quantization. For that, we defined momentum canonically conjugate to the field itself. So it will be pi of t and x, which is derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to time derivative of the field. And in this simple case, this is just time derivative itself. So it's phi dot of t and x. And then on this momentum and the field, we impose the canonical commutation relation that these two should commute at the same time, but at different positions. They should commute on a delta function. Well, with some minus I factor, minus or plus? Yeah, minus I factor. Have you seen something like this before?
Yes.
If somebody haven't, yeah, go ahead.
Before we go there, so step one is just solving the equation with A just being some complex numbers as the coefficient in front of the normal mode, right?
Yeah.
And now the second step, we're going to say, play the standard canonical quantization scheme and say, okay, that's an operator, so let's...
Yeah, we're coming there, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, first I want to promote the field itself to an operator, yeah, and then... Yeah, presumably this A and A dagger will also be promoted to operators, and I want to figure out their properties. Yes, that's where we're heading. So, okay, so this is one commutation relation. Yeah, this is supplemented by commutation relation that equal time correlators of momentum with itself and of the field with itself is zero. indeed, kind of taking these relations, imposing them, postulating them using the rules of canonical quantization, we substitute this expansion in here, and we find out that this implies commutation relations for A and A dagger of this form, that A's and with different momenta or same momenta doesn't matter, but yeah, if I take just A's commutation of A's with themselves, it should be zero, whereas the commutator of A and A dagger should be one delta function. (Clears throat) Yeah, delta function, well, I mean, this delta, canonical delta is the same as delta function. So good, so we get here. Then we look at these commutation relations and realize that this operator, they can be interpreted as particle creation and annihilation operators, or creating and annihilating quanta of the field. Yeah, so the last step here is to define the Fock space. To define this Fock space using the following relation. Namely, well, given that, maybe I should not move that far. So given that A is an annihilation operator, we define the vacuum as the state which is killed by all of them. So we say that that's the definition of the vacuum, and then any other state in the Hilbert space is just produced from this vacuum by creation operators, by some product of creation operators. Yeah, so K1, A dagger, KN acting on the vacuum. So in this way, we define everything. We define the Hilbert space, and we define the operators acting on it. So now our field is quantum, so we can do whatever we want. Yeah, go ahead.
I think it might just be a question of normalization, but I think remembering that there's a 2 pi to the cube in the commutator of A and A dagger.
I'm using different normalization.
Oh, okay.
That's the one from the book also, and yeah, it's kind of... it's more convenient to generalize.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just different definition of different normalization of the operators.
Yeah.
So yeah, in particular, so I say we can define everything, or we can define a result of like outcome of any measurement. So in particular, we can say what will be result of measuring, like how many particles we have, right? And we can introduce particle number operator, say in some. Yeah, I cannot really say, you know, how many particles with given momentum I have because it's continuous variable, but I can integrate around, say, momentum k. I can introduce some particle number operator measuring like number of particles in a window around this momentum using this formula. I can do it. Where f is some function, just window function, basically. Some window function localized around a given momentum. You need this kind of smearing to define this operator. Of course, if I measure like number of particles in the vacuum, I will get zero, just because the vacuum is annihilated by any annihilation operator. But in a general like state, it will be non-zero, and I can basically ask these questions what it is and make predictions about this. Okay, very good. So that was a quick review of the standard approach. Actually still remaining...
Oops.
Yeah, still within this standard approach, we can be a bit more careful technically. Namely, this step, which I said, okay, we all know that from these commutation relations, we get that. But in fact, you can also say it otherwise. If I postulate these relations, I can verify that, you know, like if I take these relations, insert them into expression for phi, and compute these correlators, yeah, I can just verify that they obey that they are correct. But we can be a bit more precise, you know, how we go from here to here, and that will be also useful for generalizations. Namely, let's define a scalar product on the space of solutions of Klein-Gordon equation, of this scalar equation. So if I have two solutions, phi one, phi two, then the scalar product, by definition, is the following. So I integrate over three-dimensional. Well, I integrate over a slice at fixed time. So here I have fixed time slice. And I integrate the following combination. So it's phi 1 dt phi 2 star minus dt phi 1 phi 2 star. Okay. Well, it is a scalar product, but it's a bit unusual. It's not positive definite, for example. And yeah, we'll discuss a bit more properties about like properties of it later in more general context. But so far, an exercise for you. Yeah, I think it's exercise 5 for today, is to show that for like plane waves that we discussed before, those that we have like that they have the following product. So UK prime is equal to delta K minus K prime. So positive frequency modes, they are they form kind of orthogonal bases. Well, no, that's wrong to say they form orthogonal bases. They are orthogonal to each other, okay, let's say, and they have non-zero norm, like positive norm. Positive and negative frequency modes, they are orthogonal to each other, and negative frequency modes, they have negative norm. By the way, in checking these relations, you should also find that this product, you know, like these products, they are independent of the choice of time that we kind of take here to evaluate this integral. So this is time independent. And yeah, as I already said, it's not positive definite. And you know, we see here, we see this explicitly in here in the last expression where we get negative, essentially norm of this negative modes. So why this scalar product is useful? Because it actually allows to easily express, you know, like these creation and annihilation operators from the field itself. So we now just have that this operator AK is a projection of the field phi on negative frequency mode, on positive frequency mode. And dagger, AK dagger, with minus sign projection of phi on the negative frequency mode. We see it from these orthogonality relations and from the expression for phi, right? I just multiply it.
Question?
Yeah.
So standard quantum mechanics, you define the net product on a Hilbert space, and it's a map that takes two things that live on the Hilbert space and spits out a number. Now that we have the Fock space, is that defined on a Fock space?
No, it's not really. It's not really Fock space. It's just solutions of this equation, Klein-Gordon equation. So it's at the level of functions, right? So I have a like functional space that solves Klein-Gordon equation.
Mm-hmm.
And on this functional space, I define the scalar product. So this functional space cannot be promoted to Hilbert space because this scalar product is not positive, for example. So.
Okay. So we are operating at the level of like functions.
Yeah, these are functions. Yes. So this is product of functions, not operators. Yeah, that's before quantization, if you want. And also here, well, here that's already operator, but what it means that I, well, what it means is it literally means this type of integral. So I'm taking, you know, I'm taking this operator and integrating it with a function, in this case, and well, I get something, you know, which comes out, which is an operator also. Yeah.
Does this action have a name?
Which action?
This action up here. The
this one?
Yeah.
No, I don't think this has a name. The equation has a name of Klein-Gordon. Two names.
It's, I don't know, it's something else because it's got an R dependence in it.
Yeah, some generalization. Generalized Klein Gordon.
Minimally coupled.
I mean, scalar action, you know, like just, yeah, I mean, for the action, yeah, it's just an action.
Is it kind of like a driven one? Is it kind of like a driven one, quite a curvature?
It's not really driven. Well, it depends, of course. Okay, very good. So it depends whether this metric is static or not. So, yeah, if it changes, actually, yeah, you can think of it as driven by the change in the geometry, and we also have, we'll consider that as well. Yes, that's right.
Other than the magic number that you mentioned up here, that leads to other symmetries, whatever, is there a good motivation for having such an action?
With this additional non-minimal coupling? Yes, because that's a term that you can write. So in quantum field theory, we usually argue that, you know, whatever can be written should be included.
Okay.
And this is one of the terms that can be written, and yeah, it can be... Well, actually, the rationale behind the statement is that if we include also quantum fluctuations, like all terms that are allowed will be generated. All terms that are allowed by the symmetries, yeah, will be generated. So this term will be generated, yeah, at some level. So it's okay to include it from the start. Of course, I'm not discussing, well, actually start from free scalar. But yeah, if this, no, but even the interaction of the scalar with curvatures or with metric is already there, yes. So if I kind of think about loops of which mixes scalar and gravity, yeah, this term will be generated.
Question.
Yeah.
To have conformal symmetry for the equation of motion to be conformally invariant, M must be 0 and
B
must be.
No, M must be 0 and Xi should be this, depending on D.
So this is...
So in two dimensions, actually, Xi should be zero. That's the simplest case. In four dimensions, Xi should be 1/6, right? Yeah, 1/6. Okay, so having this, we can... So having this, we can actually derive, you know, like straightforwardly derive this commutation relations just by... You know, by computing these two expressions with each other, kind of including the integrals and everything, okay, and we get that the commutator is the scalar product of the modes. So we recover our commutation relation that we wanted, right? We can also do it for the other commutators similarly. Yeah, I think that's good point to make a pause, to make a break, like 10-minute break. Okay, I think we'll continue. Okay, people perhaps will show up soon.
So this is kind of
questions.
The quadratic part of like the full action, right? Because normally we would write this with like the just R term in the metric. But since we're only looking at like getting the equations 4, 5, we're not writing it.
Right. So this is purely scalar part. So I'm not considering dynamics of the metric,
right.
And we're not gonna have it in this course. Well, maybe we'll mention a little bit, but yeah, basically the gravitational action is left kind of outside.
What's the question? So the fact that we're solving for flat spacetime allows us to have a global coordinate system such that we can do this splitting with some time and some space. And I guess when we do the curved version, that might be difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. Very good. So actually, that's where we are. Where we want to go now. Now we want to generalize this construction to an arbitrary metric. We still have the same equation. And let's see what we can kind of do, yeah, going through these steps one by one, what can be retained and what cannot be retained. So in the step A, we have to choose, so basically instead of, well, not instead, but kind of this step A is becoming a bit more involved, because if we are in an arbitrary metric with which probably is curved, so there are different coordinate choices, and we have to fix what I mean to perform this quantization. We have to fix some. So in geometrical language, we are saying that we have to choose a foliation of space-time by space-like surfaces. So choose space-like foliation. Well, so like in a big space-time, we have, we need a collection of surfaces that are parameterized by they can be defined, in this big space, I have some coordinates x mu, which run from 0 to d. And I can define a time function on my manifold, which would be t, will be some function of x mu. And these surfaces, they will be labeled by constant value of this function. So this is my time now, right? So kind of one of possible choices of time. There can be different. So let me call these surfaces sigma, or sigma with label t. So with different times, they are kind of time labels them. And also on the same picture, I can say that, okay, time flows this in this way, kind of perpendicular. Well, not necessarily perpendicular, but kind of let's say perpendicular to the surfaces. So another object I will need is actually normal to the surface, normal unit vector to the surfaces, which I will denote with n mu. N mu with lower indices is just normalized gradient of this time function. So the norm of mu is minus 1. Then on these surfaces, I can define induced metric. So the big metric from the whole space-time, it kind of descends on the surface. That's, you can imagine, like in flat space-time, I can embed, I can put the surface, and there will be some metric on it. Actually, it has a very simple expression. So this metric on the surface is just g mu nu plus n mu n nu. We see that, kind of having this relation, we see that if I multiply this metric by n, I actually get 0, so this is a projector. This is a projector on the surface. So whatever any vector I have, if I multiply by this, will project on the surface. And last thing I will need are coordinates on the surface, which I will denote with sigma alpha, say, where alpha runs from 1 to d. So zero's coordinate is missing. Okay, so that were some preliminaries. No. With these preliminaries, we can define the scalar product on solutions, as we did almost as we did before. So now just let me use the eraser. So we just use the same formula with the following modification. So here I integrate at fixed sigma, pick up any of the surfaces and integrate along it. Here I will put d minus 1 sigma. And here I have to have derivative, like perpendicular to the surface. So that's actually defined in the following way. So here I write d mu, I also put d mu. Here I put n mu, right? So this contraction of n mu with gradient produces me the component of the gradient perpendicular to the surface, basically derivative in the orthogonal direction. And something is still missing here. Who knows what is missing? Yeah, very good. So I have to put also the root square of this induced metric G sigma to make the whole thing covariant, so that it does not depend on the choice of coordinates on the surface.
It doesn't depend on the choice of sigma
2? Yeah, very good question. That's an exercise. Precisely. So, exercise 6, show that this product does not depend on the choice of sigma, in this foliation, or, there are some conditions on this choice. So, basically, these different sigmas, it does not depend. On the choice of sigma or sigma prime, how I choose the surface, as long as sigma can be continuously deformed into sigma prime. Yeah, so if sigma is deformable into sigma prime continuously. Yeah, maybe there is another kind of condition that their asymptotics in the space like direction should be the same. So either they should be parallel like here, or they could have common boundary. So in other words, if I choose this surface or something like this, That won't matter. Okay, so that's exercise for you. Now, properties of this color product. Yeah, let me see where I want to write it. So a few properties actually exactly the same as in flat space that we discussed before. So first, we have that interchanging these two functions in the scalar product gives out the complex conjugate. So second, the product of a function on itself is not positive definite. So say it's not bigger than zero, not necessarily. It can be either positive or negative, or actually zero even, with certain choices. Actually, that follows, maybe that's trivial. Fact, because it follows, it trivially follows from the second, from the third property, which is that if I take these phis, complex conjugate them, then I will get minus minus the product of the original functions interchanged. Yeah.
And also, like for the second, we could add. Couldn't we add that the equality is only obtained if and only if the field itself is zero?
No.
No. Okay.
No. Because. Not because, but okay. No, another property. Yeah, it's not directly related, really. But yeah, that if I multiply the function by its complex conjugate, I get zero always. But this can be either sign, and by proper kind of. So this being zero doesn't imply that phi is zero. No.
Oh, because it's not positive.
Because it's not positive definite. Yeah.
Right. Makes sense.
Okay. More questions? Yeah.
What if instead of hypersurfaces, we define a scalar product for congruous observers?
That won't give us what we want. So we want to do canonical quantization. So for canonical quantization, we have to choose some kind of time, right, and space. And that's what we're doing here. So we're saying, OK, this will be our space. Now, good thing that what we are doing is covariant, that it does not really depend on the choice of the space, as long as certain, you know, like asymptotic properties, for example, are the same. So, but you cannot rotate the space-like surface into time-like. Yeah, then things would become singular. For example, this metric will become singular at some point. And well, true that there is some other like approach, quantization of light cones, of light-like on light-like surfaces. One can do that, but that's kind of more complicated and much less intuitive. But one cannot go to time-like, yeah, to do that. So yeah, last thing I want to emphasize about this, that this is really like, this is scalar product on solutions. Yeah, that's important to say. On solutions of Klein-Gordon equation, or generalized Klein-Gordon. So the properties we are discussing, they are like true if I really, if these phis are solutions of this equation. I mean, especially this this exercise that I gave you. Okay, good. So now let's go to step to the next step. So now for us it's step B, because yeah, we had to do these preliminaries. So in the step B we are, yeah, actually let me put here. So step B, we are to choose modes, to choose a complete set of modes with okay, we'll label with the indices I, with some labels. Basically with the properties of plane waves. So what this should be? So the properties should be that scalar product of what we call positive frequency modes gives delta ij. Scalar product of positive and negative frequencies gives zero. And scalar product of negative frequencies give minus delta ij. So these are not plane waves anymore, right? Because these are solutions with non-trivial metric, and yeah, depending on the form of the metric, you know, this equation is different. I can have different solutions, really. But I can always choose them in such a way that they satisfy these properties. That's kind of clear, right? If you think of it, yeah, one can do mathematical proof, but physically that should be clear because, you know, if I think of like space-time kind of continuously obtained from deformation of Minkowski. I have plane waves in Minkowski, so I will have the same kind of sets, continuously deforming these sets into curved metric. And then, okay, having this basis, we decompose the field in these modes.
We have singular spacetimes.
Yeah, singular spacetimes, it's rather not about singularity, it's more about like global properties of spacetime, yeah, I mean, or topological changes. Yeah, maybe this naive argument doesn't work like directly, but then you have to go to mathematical theorems.
So it still works, yeah.
This works, yes. So this statement is still true, so you can choose this, this basis in this way. okay, so once we have chosen the basis, then we expand the field into this basis. And we also define momentum, canonical momentum, which will be now derivative with respect to, you know, to the time derivative of the field, you know, in this sense, right? In the sense of this time function. So if I look at the action, if I kind of apply it to the Lagrangian, I will find that this should be square root of the metric on the surface, and then projection of the time derivative of phi, you know, on the perpendicular direction to the surface. Okay, so we're here. So now we canonically quantize. Basically, this step I already did. Okay, let me remove it. So then we have to impose. We basically go through the same steps. So we impose the canonical commutation relations in here. So it becomes P of sigma phi of sigma prime should give here delta function sigma minus sigma prime. And correspondingly, here this commutator should be zero. As before, I impose the commutation relations on a surface of constant time, right? That's what I'm doing. That's why only sigma appears here in these formulas. Let me go through one more step. Let me write here. And then I can, you know, like, then I express. That's where my scalar product again becomes handy. I can express these amplitudes, A and A dagger. I express them using the modes. So in this case, it's an integral of this form. I mean, well, I'm just using this scalar product definition. So we have d sigma square root of g sigma and mu d mu ui star times phi minus ui star times phi. And similarly for complex conjugate. Actually, let me write it. So having this expression, I just take them and compute this type of commutators. Okay, now with general indices, ij. And for these two, I find that this is zero. And for this one, I find that this is delta function. Or Kronecker delta. So very good. So basically, at the end, we arrive to the same picture as in flat space. So we ended up with operators that we can identify as creation and annihilation operators of particles or quanta of the field. So we can do also the next step and define the Fock space, which I think I erased. So we can define the Fock space by postulating that the vacuum is annihilated by all AIs. And all like other states, they are just obtained by creation operators. Okay, so far the story looks very much the same as in flat space. Do you have any questions about this story? Okay.
Let me see.
Okay, so true, that's like in flat space, but there is some new feature appearing here, namely that this choice, well, actually many choices that we did are not unique. Okay, one choice we discussed, the choice of the quantization surfaces, doesn't matter, but the choice of this basis over there does matter. So in principle, yeah, let me erase this part. In principle, I can make another choice. I can consider another set of modes. So let's say it's like item 3 for today, topic 3, which is ambiguity. Ambiguity in definition of particles, in the notion of particle even. The notion of particles. So this choice of the basis is not unique. So I can imagine having another basis with modes U tilde and their complex conjugate with the same properties. And in fact, that happens, and we will consider explicit examples later on. So when I say the same properties, mean that satisfy the same orthogonality conditions, then I can go through the same derivation and get to, well, actually using this basis, which is also complete, I can also expand the same field, phi, I can expand in this new basis. Put twiddles everywhere, then go through the same derivation, canonical quantization and everything, and arrive to a different Fock space. Yeah, arrive to the Fock space based on the vacuum with twiddle, which obeys this condition. Okay, and then I build up any other states using creation operators. So in general, that gives different result, physically different result. Let's see in the general formalism why that happens. Let me erase this action. I think that already has stayed here for enough. So very generally, like because both sets U and U twiddle, because they are complete, we can re-expand, you know, like these basis functions in terms of each other. So we can expand, there exists some expansion of this U twiddle in terms of U and U star. With certain coefficients, like constant coefficients, beta alpha ji and beta ji. So here, I mean, this depends on x, this depends on x, that depends on x, and alpha beta are just numbers, yeah, are just some coefficients. Well, they have these labels ji, so you can think of them as matrices that transform between, you know, between this basis and this basis. Well, of course, we also have complex conjugate, which just follows from here by complex conjugation, but let me write it for future reference. (Clears throat) So using our nice scalar product, we can write kind of compact relations for compact expressions for these alphas and betas. So we see that alpha ji is the scalar product of uj Tweedle times ui. Yeah, I'm just multiplying this expression by ui, and that's what I get. And beta ji is minus multiplication of this uj Tweedle by ui complex conjugate. Now, an exercise for you is to prove completeness relations for these coefficients alpha and beta. So, exercise 7. I mean, these relations, they follow from the fact that the two bases, u star and u Tweedle, u star Tweedle, that both of them are complete. That implies certain some rules for these alphas and betas. Namely, by the way, do you see when I write here? I think somehow quality, is it visible? Because to me it looks like the contrast has dropped, you know? Well, anyway, if it's visible, that's good. When it stops being visible, tell me.
Depends on your reference frame.
Yeah, there's a bit of redshift or something happening. Okay, so the completeness relations are like this. So if I have a sum, yeah, let me write them, and yeah, they will be also in the exercise kind of sheets that I will post on the Google Drive. But yeah, nevertheless, put them here. So that's one, and there is another sum, ji. By the way, in all these formulas, it's important to distinguish between quantities and their complex conjugate because, well, it's quantum mechanics and phases are important. So that's why I'm carefully putting these complex conjugations here. Yeah, and then there is also, there's a pair of relations when we sum over the second index. So your task is to prove these relations. Once we have this, well, why would we need these relations? We need these relations to actually be able to work with these formulas, to be able to invert them, for example. So I can use, say, these two, I think these two, to invert this linear relation and write u's in terms of u Tweedles. So this u will be sum over I alpha, it's here, sum over j alpha j I u j Tweedle minus beta ji uj Tweedle star, and similarly for complex conjugate. Right, okay, so we can make this inversion. We can also relate the creation annihilation operators, right? Once I have that, I use where are those expressions? Actually, those expressions over there. These ones. I use this expression and do it in here. So I will say that, well, we know that, yeah, we use this formula, but then I'm kind of this phi, I can express like in both ways. I can express using like my original modes or these twiddle ones. So if I insert the twiddle ones, this formula will produce me that AI is equal to, yeah, actually, let's do it. So I have this sum J UJ twiddle AJ twiddle plus UJ twiddle star AJ twiddle dagger, and all that contracted with UI. So now I know what the products, you know, I know these products, this one, and I know also the properties of this, you know, of the scalar product. So altogether, I will get that this is sum over J alpha J I A J twiddle plus beta J I star A J twiddle star dagger. Okay, so we see that the old annihilation operator is a linear combination of the new annihilation operators and new creation operators. Also, conversely, new annihilation operator is a linear sum of the old ones. And also old creation operators. So this type of transformations that mix creation and annihilation operators, they are called Bogoliubov transformation. So they were actually first appeared in condensed matter systems. But then it happens, you know, like in field theory and curved spacetime, they're also very, very relevant. That's this Bogoliubov transformation between different, well, Bogoliubov transformation induced by the choice of the basis. And okay, so far it just looks like dry math, but in fact it has an important like physical implication. So imagine that these betas are non-zero. Yeah, so that's an interesting case. By the way, if beta is zero, then actually nothing dramatic happens. We just kind of re-express like new operators in terms of old ones, and yeah, basically we live in the same Hilbert space. But if this is non-zero, we get something interesting. Namely, consider the number. Yeah, consider just the number particle number operator constructed using new creation annihilation operator. So basically, I measure number of particles using you know, like this new basis. Yeah, and I measure this number of particles in the vacuum, in the old vacuum. So say I have something like this. Ah, and here I put twiddles. So if I put this expression inside here, like the terms, well, some terms will vanish, but there will be one term which does not, namely the one which involves this part. So we have here yeah, actually let me do it, maybe. So okay, so here I will have sum over I alpha j I dagger star a I no star a I dagger minus beta j I a I first term. Times, so that's new creation operator. Okay, so here I put new annihilation operator. So it's alpha jk pk, I have star, minus beta jk star ak dagger. And all that acts on the vacuum. Now, if an annihilation operator acts on the vacuum, that gives zero, so this term drops out. If a creation operator acts on the vacuum on the left, that also gives zero, so this term drops out. But the remaining, these two terms, they don't drop out. They remain. So we'll be getting here, this is sum over I and k, beta ji, beta dagger jk. And here I have AI, AK dagger. Now, what I do here, I commute them to basically to pull the annihilation operator to the right so that it annihilates the vacuum. But the commutator we know is non-zero, is delta IK. So that will produce delta IK. So overall, I will have that this is sum over I, beta ji, absolute value squared. And you see the sum of positive numbers. So I will get some positive and non-zero value for the average number of particles in the vacuum. I mean, new particles in the old vacuum. OK, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, just so the last letters are D-Y-A-L-O-V, right? Is that, so what's the last?
B-O-V, yeah.
Yeah, but it's B-O-V and D-Y-A-B-O-V, right?
B-O-G-O-L-Y-U-B-O-V.
Oh, OK, I see.
OK. So in other words, now it's physical, like physical interpretation. So if we really use to measure number, if we define particles somehow, our device is such that it measures the number of particles using this decomposition. Okay, there is Alice and Bob. And Alice has one device, Bob has another device. And Alice creates the field in the vacuum state in her frame. She works in terms of these old operators A without tweedles. So she creates a vacuum, she measures, there's an empty space. But for Bob, who uses different decomposition or kind of different device that somehow measures the number of particles in using these new operators, Bob will measure non-empty space, yeah? Will measure that there are some particles in this state. And also other way around, if Bob creates an empty state, basically kind of empties the space out of particles, then for Alice, it will become like full or at least non-empty, okay. question.
How exactly the choice of the basis corresponds to the choice of the detector?
Oh, by the way, well, very good question, and we'll discuss both definitions, you know, using bases and using detectors. There are different diagnostics to probe like presence or absence of particles. So one is from the point of view of this global like canonical quantization and global decomposition. Another one is using local detectors. There, sometimes they coincide, so basically they would give the same answer, saying that a state with a given number of particles will be detected as having this number of particles in both ways, but not necessarily. So they all reduce actually to the same, they are guaranteed to give the same answer in flat spacetime. Or in spacetime, which is asymptotically flat, when we kind of put everything asymptotically far away from the region of the curvature. But inside the curved region, all these methods, they will actually give different answers in general. And to really get yeah, you can say how do I get physical predictions out of it? That just means that you have to formulate very precisely the physical question that you want to answer. So for one or another question, one or another kind of method will be more appropriate.
So what was the analogous thing in the condensed matter physics? So
this one,
instead of like,
well, it's the same transformation. Now, how it appeared? Well, actually, the same transformation appears. Well, in the Bogoliubov case, actually, it appeared due to interactions, but which was treated using mean field approximation. Yeah. So in other words, yeah, the same transformation will appear. So here we are doing for gravity, but actually for any external field. So for example, if I have electromagnetic field that changes and there are some charged particles living in it, in principle, in general, it will give rise to the same. Well, basically, the formalism just goes through the same way. And again, it gives rise to ambiguity of definition of particles. In particular, it can lead to this type of transformations. So, for example, imagine you have a box where you switch on electric field for a while and then switch it off. Yeah, so it will produce pairs of electrons, right? That's what we know physically, but this type of description that will manifest itself as non-trivial Bogoliubov transformation between the initial vacuum and the final vacuum. Well, maybe now to go back in history and say what Bogoliubov did, he did it for Bose-Einstein condensate. Yes, a weakly interacting Bose gas where this mean field arises from the condensate. And in that case, the excitations, like physical excitation, they are a mixture of the true of the fundamental like creation annihilation operators of these bosons or atoms, whatever. Marco, yeah?
So if I am Bob, is there like a relative property to me that chooses a canonical basis? Or is it completely arbitrary even for me?
As I say, it depends what you want to measure. Okay. So for example, if there is some kind of transient event and then everything goes back to Minkowski space, then very natural choice, which is almost forced on you, is the choice of this usual plane wave quantization. So basically, modes which are positive negative frequencies with respect to global Minkowski time. Because this state is invariant, for example, it's the same for all inertial observers. So in this sense, it's really preferred. You are not forced to, by the way. Yeah, and also it depends whether you are an inertial observer or not. If you are not an inertial observer, perhaps you would like to choose another natural basis. I think in a sense, yeah, even in flat space, actually, like next week we'll have a lecture where we'll consider a few examples. So far it's a bit abstract, but we'll consider a few explicit examples where kind of the choice of basis is naturally determined by the physical question that we want to answer. But also it's clear that even, it also will become clear that even in flat space, it's not unique, right? Again, depending on the question, you can choose another one or one or another.
It's a bit of, ambiguous question, but like, can we say that curved spacetime is essentially flat spacetime in the background of some non-trivial interactions? In the presence of some background.
No, I think the better way to say it that like locally every curved space-time is flat, right? So in fact, locally we should more or less be able to determine vacuum. Even if you go at kind of scales much shorter than the curvature radius, there we have a well-defined notion of the vacuum state, which is empty with respect to basically we should not see particles with very high energies. On the other hand, when we can start extending, formalism or detectors to particles that have energies or wavelengths comparable to the size of the curvature radius, then these preferences disappear. Yeah, so then we start feeling curvature, and then we don't really know what the particle is, because this particle, yeah, it actually has to do with the uncertainty principle. So when we look at heavy particles, okay, they can be well localized, and we can really say whether they are present or not. But when it comes to particles that have like wavelengths that are, say, as big as a black hole, for example, you cannot really say if it's there or not. I mean, kind of you become sensitive to how this curvature behaves, actually.
Is it like a fundamental thing or like emergent in a sense? Curved space.
Well, I think, well, I don't know in which sense you mean that. Yeah, in which sense emergent? Yeah, maybe another way to say the particle, as it's clear from this general derivation, is a global notion. So to define what particle is, you really have to take, it really involves decomposition, the complete decomposition of the field on the whole surface. But of course, physically, we understand that, you know, like when we are going to very high energies, we should be able to localize this question, and indeed, that's possible. But it's in principle impossible, when the wavelengths are large.
Okay. Can we say something similar to the case of the original Bogoliubov transformation with the electromagnetic field? So there, what would be the analog for this feeling of the curvature by the particles?
Of course, the time scales of the change of the field. So if you're asking about particles which have masses much bigger or energies much bigger than the frequency of the field, then I mean they're not there, they're not produced. So only those that have low frequencies are produced, which feel kind of this global change. Okay, let's stop here and see you next week.